I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. College-educated young adults are very much in demand. You could call them the new buffalo being hunted by mayors and economic development officials hoping to make their cities more successful. CEOs for Cities just commissioned TSC, a division of Yankelovich, to conduct a first-ever study to find out where members of this coveted demographic are choosing to live and why. Meredith Gilfeather, the senior researcher on the project, will tell us whether young adults are choosing the job or the city. And we'll find out which city topped the most preferred list of cities and which city was least preferred. Plus, we'll talk to a young entrepreneur, Megan Jones, about her experiences in starting and operating a business. That's today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Meredith Gilfeather is senior researcher for the Segmentation Company, a division of Yankelovich. She led the company's recent project for CEOs for Cities to find out what college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds are looking for in cities. Meredith, you just completed a study for CEOs for Cities to find out why college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds are moving to the places they are moving. What did you find?
Well, first of all, we found that about two-thirds of them, 64%, are choosing the city that they want to live in before they choose the job they want. So, in other words, they're not letting the job dictate where they live. They really want to be able to choose where they want to live rather than the other way around. And that's true whether we're talking about married or unmarried folks, people with children or people without children. Men are a little bit more likely to let the job lead them to where to live, but not that much more likely than women. The other thing that we found that's interesting is that when deciding where to live, young college-educated people are not moving far from their own comfort zone. So, in other words, they're looking for places that are similar to where they live currently or close to where they grew up geographically.
Interesting. Did the headline of the report, this two-thirds of college-educated young adults choosing the city before the job, did that surprise you?
It really did, because typically we see that people need to go where the jobs are. And this is not to say that two-thirds of college-educated young people are actually going to move to a city without a job. What it does is it really speaks to the importance of the choice of where to live in their minds. So they're really choosing quality of life first and then trying to figure out how they can make it work in the place that they choose.
How do you explain this finding? What do you think's going on?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is that there are more choices available to people out there in terms of how and where they would like to work. They can telecommute, they can work independently. The other thing is that there are more women in the workforce now, so that they are more concerned about quality of life and they are going to be moving to a place where they think that they can meet their expectations rather than following their husbands to wherever it is their job takes them. The other thing is that there is no expectation of permanent employment anymore. So people who are coming into the workforce now don't have this vision of working for the same company for 30, 40 years and leaving with a gold watch. They really expect to change jobs every few years, every 5 to 7 years.
You said that you think women are more concerned with quality of life than are men. Why do you think that's true?
Well, they're really looking for a place that they can raise a family and make the life that they want to live. So when they're looking for cities, both men and women are looking for someplace that's clean, green, and safe to live. But they're also looking for a place where they can develop their careers and reach their life aspirations and goals. And we see that more strongly among women than among men.
Now, you mentioned what I know is the first set of basic attributes that young adults are looking for in cities. And you said it's clean and attractive, green, safe, opportunity to live the kind of life I want to live. What else is in that first set of attributes, Meredith?
Well, someplace where I can buy a house, I can grow professionally, personally, and raise a family. And then once those requirements are met, they're really looking for a place where they can make connections and have the lifestyle they want to live. So they're looking for a diverse community where they can really find their niche in the community. They want to have outdoor gathering places where even if they're not necessarily meeting people, there's activity around them and they can feel like they're a part of something.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about your survey, which as far as I know is the first time college-educated young adults nationally have been surveyed on whether they choose the city, choose the job, and how they make their decisions about cities, has been done, but it certainly reinforces everything we've been hearing in focus groups over the last 2 to 3 years with the same demographic group. It's nice to have it confirmed with statistically valid research. Given, of course, you've done surveys in many, many areas, politics, consumer products, lifestyles, all sorts of things. Was there anything about the findings that you found surprising or difficult to explain?
Well, the one thing I found surprising was even though these folks are willing to move around and willing to explore new places, their depth of knowledge of specific areas was really not there. When they're thinking about where they want to live next and the things that attract them to certain areas, they're really not familiar with places other than where they are right now. And that's part of why they want to stay in their same geographic area, but also, you know, even the places far away that they think they might want to live, they don't know anything about it other than sort of the very high level, almost stereotypical things about places. They don't know much about the personalities of different neighborhoods, for example.
Mm-hmm. And neighborhoods were an important factor in that they were looking for?
Neighborhoods were a very important factor. Again, they're looking for some place that they can, you know, once they meet those basic requirements, they're looking for some place where they belong, where they can make connections, where they see themselves really developing as a person and a professional. And having diverse, interesting neighborhoods is part of that.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting communication challenge for cities, I think, because, you know, you can only command so much time and attention. You can only say a few things. You have to say it over and over for it to gain any traction at all. And so for a city to think beyond its overall image, beyond what it instantly stands for, and get down to the neighborhood level is a challenge.
Absolutely. But there are a couple of very encouraging things coming out of this study. First of all, since there isn't a very strong perception of a lot of these cities, there's a chance for cities to define themselves rather than having to overcome perceptions that are already out there. The other thing is, this is a very internet-savvy group. When we ask them how they're going to find out about new places where they're considering to live, there's experiential things like going there themselves, talking to friends, talking to family, but also they're going to go to local websites. So the challenge for cities is really to think about how they can use web tools to help young people do some virtual exploring in their city. So maybe it's, you know, getting to know certain neighborhoods, a clickable map that helps people understand the difference between different areas, having features in the local newspaper website that talks about different areas and what's happening in them, things like that they'll really respond to.
It also occurred to me looking at that finding that when you realize that young people make decisions off of experience, their own experience and the experience of their friends and family, it suggests that urban leaders may want to take the visitor opportunity, the visitor experience, and drill down and push out toward neighborhoods. We did, as you know, some interviews recently with young entrepreneurs at CEOs for Cities and asked them for advice to urban leaders. And these were particularly young urban entrepreneurs who were remaking in-town neighborhoods like Wicker Park in Chicago. And one of the things one of the retail shop owners told us is that she would advise the city to package neighborhoods like Wicker Park as a shopping destination for visitors to the city. And, at first pass, that may seem like a trivial recommendation or or certainly self-beneficial. But on the other hand, you think that could be actually a very good way to get visitors to the city experienced with something beyond, again, the obvious tourist things that, you know, once you move to a city, you don't really see much of.
Absolutely. And if you think about how we travel to cities, I mean, you and I travel all the time. How often do we really get beyond the airport where we're having our meeting and then the hotel? And even leisure travelers, they're going to come in and they're going to stay at their hotel and they're going to go to the tourist sites or whatever. If the cities can really help point out to visitors that there's more beyond that and help show visitors the way. If you think about it, it's a little bit scary coming to a new city and not knowing which way to go and how to get there. So using the Wicker Park example, there might be some folks who come to town and want to experience that kind of neighborhood but don't really know how to get there, what to do, what's going to be there when I get there, is it dangerous? So there are some things that we can do to help push them out to these neighborhoods and show them where there are things that are unique. You know, not just the things that you can see in your local mall, but other types of shops, other types of restaurants, and just different neighborhood feels and personalities so they can get to know the city better.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of the packaging. There seems to be a huge opportunity there. We're talking about a new study for CEOs for Cities conducted by TSC, a division of Yankelovich, by Meredith Gilfeather. She is Senior Account Director, and you're listening to Smart City. You named this packaging of neighborhoods as one big opportunity for urban leaders to attract and retain young adults based on this new survey. Other opportunities, where do urban leaders, in your opinion, based on what you learned, have their best opportunity to influence the choices of this desirable demographic?
Well, first of all, it's showing them that the city itself is clean, green, and safe. Now, that's not the kind of thing that's going to necessarily bring people to the city if they're considering a number of different places to live, but it's something that can knock a city out of the consideration set. So those are sort of the basic quality of life issues that you need to address. After that, it's really thinking about the aspirations of this group. What is it they want to do? How can we help them grow personally and professionally? And that may be, you mentioned the Wicker Park example earlier. Part of that might be creating better opportunities for entrepreneurship or facilitating the growth of new business in an area by making the process easier, by having caseworkers to help you walk through the process of starting up a business, or just having the information more readily available to young people who might be considering doing that. And then the higher level aspiration here is to have connections and build the kind of lifestyle that they want. Again, it's finding where they belong, finding groups that they want to be part of, and being able to feel like this is the life that they want to live, that they have places for social interactions, that they are part of their neighborhood or community.
So the whole idea of plug and play, make it really simple to plug in and get connected.
Exactly. Not all of this is necessarily about messaging. A lot of it is really about facilitating. So if you think about, you know, going back to those basic quality of life issues, the clean, green, and safe, it's not about talking about when the garbage collection is and how good a job you do collecting the garbage. It's really about just doing it. Because remember, this is a group of people who grew up with advertising from day one. They're very, very marketing savvy. And they're not necessarily going to believe something that they hear and do not see. When that comes to aspirations, it's really showing that the city works, that there are opportunities, that there are a lot of companies that are willing to hire, that are willing to give them a chance, and, you know, showing them that there are families who are making their way in the city and making a very nice life for themselves. And the connections and lifestyles piece, it's having these outdoor gathering places, having, you know, places where it looks like people can come together and have fun. If you think about the coffee houses that have become so popular, it's not necessarily about forcing people to get together and talk to each other, but it's about having the opportunity to do so, creating a place that facilitates that interaction if you so choose.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, though, Meredith. I think you're describing, in a way, a conundrum for urban leaders, because you say facilitating rather than messaging, just do it. Don't tell people when the garbage is picked up. Make sure it is picked up and demonstrate that you're a clean and attractive city. That makes sense when you're talking about clean and safe. And it also makes sense, for instance, after people have chosen your city. But think about this. I know when that first set of attributes, those basic attributes that college-educated young adults said were important to them, was the opportunity to live the life I want to live. Now, once I move to a city, once I choose a city, then I can fairly quickly figure out if opportunity does indeed exist. But back up a minute and think about trying to influence those people who have not moved to your community. How do you telegraph opportunity to live the kind of life I want to live? In part, that is messaging, even if it's simply packaging your performance, isn't it?
Yes, I probably misspoke when I said it's not about messaging. It's not about only messaging. So you can certainly have messages that reinforce these things, but you can't just speak about them. You need to walk the walk. So, for example, if we're trying to communicate a place where you can live the life you want to live, we can certainly talk about that, but we also need to help facilitate getting to know certain neighborhoods that will get the young person to that place. So, again, going back to the Wicker Park example, if I want to live in an interesting, up-and-coming, kind of funky neighborhood, you can't just talk about that. You need to show me where that neighborhood is and push me out of that central business district a little bit so I can explore the interesting neighborhoods that exist outside of that.
Mm-hmm. Although we should also remember that young people are now 30% more likely to live in close-in neighborhoods within 3 miles of the central business district than other Americans. It's quite a remarkable leap in those numbers. In 1980, they were 10% more likely. 1990, they were 12% more likely. 2000, they were 30% more likely. So, of course, it becomes pretty obvious pretty fast who's been redeveloping what we used to call the inner city or in-town neighborhoods. I mean, young adults have had a huge impact on the quality of life, and I think you're right then to turn around and show that off. Mm-hmm. As a way to appeal to young adults is a really good idea. Okay, I've been holding this question, Meredith, until the end, but here it is. You ask those you surveyed which cities they most preferred and which ones had the least appeal. Tell me who topped the list on the most preferred and the least preferred.
Well, when we talk about the most preferred city, the top five were New York, San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Seattle. Interestingly, we have some of the same cities popping up in least attractive. When we talk about the ones that are they're least likely to consider, we see Anchorage, Alaska, New York, Washington, D.C., cities in South Dakota, and cities in Alaska other than Anchorage.
Okay, so there's clearly a weather issue going on there.
Well, what's happening here is that people don't have a very deep view of some of these cities. So when we ask why they want to live in San Diego, for example, it's all about the weather and the beach. They don't know what else San Diego might have to offer them, but they know it's sunny and they know that they can go surfing. When we ask them why they don't want to live in a place like Anchorage or South Dakota, it really comes down to it's in the middle of nowhere. You know, I don't know how I even get there, and it's cold. So again, if people are kind of going with their first gut feeling, they haven't necessarily researched why they would or would not want to live in these places.
So urban leaders have a chance to fill in the blanks for young adults that they want to attract to their city.
Absolutely. I mean, San Francisco, San Diego, New York, these are very sort of aspirational places, but they really can get in there and say, you already are positively predisposed to us. Let us tell you more about our city. Let us show you more about our city through our websites, through your visits, whatever, And so you can really picture yourself here and actually make the move.
Well, it's an exciting piece of research, Meredith. Thanks for sharing it with us today on Smart City.
Thanks, Carol. It's been my pleasure.
Meredith Gilfeather is senior researcher for TSC, a division of Yankelevich. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, you know that I spend a lot of time in Chicago and, of course, was here for the Dan Ryan Expressway shutdown. And for weeks before this occurred, the newspapers, the public radio station, television news, they were all saying it will be a disaster. And lo and behold, the construction began, the shutdown began, and there was no disaster.
Yeah. Well, isn't that remarkable? They have one great advantage in Chicago. They have an alternative way of getting around, which is the very well-developed transit system there, not only the famous L, the subway that runs above the streets, But also the commuter lines and buses and many other ways of getting around, and that is how Chicago has managed to survive the restricting of. It's not completely a shutdown. They've actually just narrowed the number of lanes that are available in one of the most used highways in America. 300,000 cars a day use the Dan Ryan Expressway. So yeah, people have shifted over to the commuter rail. They're using the L. They are getting around, and if you want to sort of contrast that with a place that could not manage even a brief interruption, Miami had to close Biscayne Boulevard, which is one of its big downtown streets, recently because a crane toppled over, and they had to secure the crane and then move it out of the way, and it took a couple of days to do this. And it just created massive congestion and chaos. Carol, trips that would normally take 45 minutes were taking 2 hours. People were driving on the sidewalks there. They were getting so furious with the congestion. And, of course, it left people in Miami with the obvious question, well, what would we do if there were a hurricane here? And it gets back to the fact that Miami has a very small and underdeveloped transit system. Chicago has a very large and robust one, and you can make changes and you can shift when things go wrong in a city with a transit system, and you can't do it when you're just living in a highway city.
I know that Miami is by no means alone on this count. Many cities are lacking those transit alternatives, and it does seem like it's all about alternatives and choice.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the thing that transit is really good at is high-capacity stuff. I mean, you can get a lot of folks on trains and move them in and out of cities. So they're particularly good for dealing with rush hour problems. And, of course, that's exactly the situation in the Dan Ryan because they're restricting the number of lanes that can be used there. So they could shift over they put a couple of extra cars on those commuter trains and shift some folks over there, and it works pretty well.
It's interesting. Each morning as I leave my condo, I have the choice of walking three blocks to the L. I have a choice of walking three blocks to a bus that makes very few stops until it gets to my home. I have the choice of catching the closest bus, which will take me up to State Street and drop me off six or seven blocks south of where I work. I can walk on a pretty day. Or if I really am ambitious, I'll go to the basement and get the bike. I don't do that often on a work day. It is amazing to walk out the door every day and think, well, let's see, How does the mood strike me? It really is a great freedom to have, to be able to make that choice. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, and you can always hail a cab, too.
And you can, I forgot about the cab, but I'll tell you what, when that prepaid transit card is in your purse, you really hate to take a cab.
I hear you.
Otis, I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Megan Jones is founder and president of Lokian, an interactive company based in Memphis. Megan, what motivated you to start Lokian?
I think that the biggest part of it is my favorite boss has always been me. And I was working very hard for a company that was based out of Cupertino, California during the dot-com surge. And I was working very intensely and making great money for both the company and myself. And then I thought, why am I doing this for somebody else? My favorite boss is me. And had learned a lot of lessons from them and what not to do. And I thought, surely I can do just as good a job, if not better. So that's what I did. I just started looking around thinking I can bring together some talent and make this happen myself.
How old were you?
Oh, Lokian has been in business for 5 years. We just had our fifth birthday. So I was 32.
You've beaten the odds.
Yes.
5 years in business, that beats the odds, doesn't it?
Yes.
For longevity.
A great big cake, and we've been profitable and debt-free for 3 out of those 5 years.
That's impressive. Is it possible, do you think? Well, describe the business you're in.
Lokian is an internet consulting company. We do design and development and strategic work for our clients. So we're looking at business goals. We're looking at processes, internal processes. We do everything from user interface design for websites to content management for those websites and software development and a host of things in between. It always makes me cringe when people say, you've got an internet company, do you do websites? And yes, but it's a lot more than that. So,
is it possible to have a first-class service business in a mid-sized market?
I think it is possible. I think it is difficult.
Why is it difficult?
It is difficult because you've got a different set of issues than you would if you were in a first-tier city. First-tier city, there's more competition. You are got a higher cost of operating the business. In the location where we are, we have some of the benefits of having a lower operating cost, but also a smaller local client pool and a smaller local talent pool. Although those types of barriers, particularly in our business, are disappearing. We have a lot of contractors who work for us. We've got one in Portland who's full-time. We've got one out of Atlanta. We've got one in D.C. One of our business partners actually lives in D.C. He's not even located here. So for us in that regard, because we utilize technology so intensely and so frequently, it's a little bit easier. But for the most part, it is a struggle to kind of break out, I think, of that regional thinking, particularly for a service business, because you're always going for the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How large of staff do you now have?
About 20.
So you have 20 people, and they are located in at least, what, 4 cities?
Yes.
What are the challenges of recruiting and managing people at a distance?
It varies. You know, it's so funny. The tech workers, they're very independent, whether they're in the design side of things or the developers. And they want different things. You know, they want to be able to, well, maybe they don't want different things, but they're more committed to it. I'll put it that way. They don't respond to typical incentives, I would say. And so in recruiting, what I have found to be the most potent incentive, I guess, is our culture. You know, and I think that is one of the bonuses that a small business can provide over a corporate culture. If you are an independent thinker, if you like where you are, if you want to work from home in your pajamas 3 days a week, if you like to wear Birkenstocks to work and bring your dog or what have you, we are flexible enough for that. And we value that. We want those independent thinkers because in the end, we are a solutions business. And our solutions come from our people. And so we wouldn't be around if we weren't thinking in such a way that other people did not or cannot within their confines. So for us, in terms of recruiting, it's be who you are, come and be with this small group of people, tell us what you need, what are your ideas, and that is very attractive, I think, to a certain segment.
Megan, the kinds of employees that you talk about hiring would collectively be described as members of the creative class. We've talked about the creative class many times on Smart City. You know where that comes from, Richard Florida's work. It is often mentioned by urban leaders. Does that frame in any way how you think about the people who work with you? Does it frame how you think about your own work and your own identity?
Absolutely. Well-versed with that term, creative class, a lot of my wonderful talent is definitely from the creative class, even though I think sometimes people don't consider software developers to be creative. They're incredibly creative. It's, you know, sometimes code is a beautiful thing. It's almost like a poem. You're trying to put everything together in just the right place with economy of form, and it's sometimes it does bother me that there is this label creative class that is applied to artistic folks. You know, these are the free thinkers who are being wooed by cities across the nation to come in and give that little something extra to the culture and add their ideas and their tolerance and their diversity to the city. But in my mind, the developers who work for me, I'm definitely feel a part of the creative class because I am creating something. It just, the output might not be what someone would think. It's not a song, it's not a piece of artwork, it's not anything like that, but it is substantial in terms of there is a creative aspect to it. Something is coming out of my effort. Supporting that within the cities and attracting that is a very difficult proposition because you would think that bigger cities would be more crowded in terms of the energy. Someone's already thought of your idea, someone's already done your idea, someone's been there, someone's seen that and had it fail. And I find it ironic that bigger cities seem to be the place, even though they're the most crowded, that have the most room for the creative class to breathe. Whereas cities that are not considered to be those first-tier cities where there is a more wide-open economy where you do have perhaps more opportunity to start something or do something that nobody has done before, that the ground is not as fertile there. And that is fascinating to me, and I don't know why that is. I'm going to figure it out at some point, but you know, whether it's the friction of, and the energy of the city or not, I'm not quite sure. We have folks who live in both places, here and in bigger cities, and I think eventually, I hope, for my sake, it'll level out.
How attached is your firm's reputation to the reputation of the city where it is primarily located?
For us, I don't think that much. I think because our clients are so large and international, we don't have as much of an issue. Lokian is, well, I want to say it's unique, maybe it's not, but I think we're unique in that we're roughly a 20-person firm with huge clients. We are not necessarily a firm that's suited for, specifically for small or medium-sized businesses. So I think because of our client base, we're not necessarily attached to our location because our clients are so internationalized and large.
So your clients, do they care where you are?
Actually, you know, they do. We just got a client 2 weeks ago that is based in Jackson, Mississippi, a large client. Very excited about it. And we were competing against other companies. They actually use an ad agency in Chicago. But we're looking for an interactive partner, and they were thrilled that we were here. You know, they were like, where did you come from? We didn't know that, you know, you were here in Memphis and you're so close. And they really want that interaction. Some of our bigger clients that are located here the same way, they use firms out of Boston, New York, Silicon Valley, but they really value us being here. So I think it goes both ways, you know, in terms of if the location working for you, working potentially against you. I think where it works against us is in having the time to go out and seek clients. Say, we have a client in Seattle, but that was, you know, that was luck. And in New York, our dream, of course, is to be able to broaden that, but still keep ourselves a boutique-sized agency.
Mm-hmm. And yet you say that clients tend to value geographic closeness.
They do. I think sometimes in our industry, I have a saying, high tech needs high touch, because what we create is incredibly ephemeral. And explaining it, talking about it, making those ideas concrete sometimes does demand the face-to-face. What doesn't necessarily demand the face-to-face is the actual building of it. We try to make our processes as transparent as possible so people see the building, you know, or they feel it. They have what I call evidence of industry. But for the initial solutions, kind of brainstorming and doing the work and identifying and talking, it's important.
It's really hard to, I found it was very hard to discern the breadth of a client's interest unless you could be on site on some sort of regular basis, because it always seemed to be that so much of those interests were expressed in informal conversations, mm-hmm. in hallway chat, in places that weren't so formal that a meeting had been called on that topic. Do you
right.
find the same thing?
I do. And I also think that what's important to a small business of any type is the relationship. And so what you're describing to me is the getting to know you is the relationship part of it. And for us, and particularly for me, and people say, you know, what makes your company different? How did you come out of the, I mean, we started in 2001, which was the trough. You know, it was, any advice that I would have would be, don't start a tech business in a tech bust. One of the things that I think is different about us is that for a technology company that is so dependent upon its knowledge and its, you know, solutions and its forward thinking, I really tend to emphasize those relationships. That, I think, is a hallmark beyond what a big business does, which to me, I think the way they get things done is networking. And networking is different than relationships. And I think it's key within any kind of small business context to have those and make them very strong, because as a small business owner, you certainly need them. I mean, if anybody had told me how difficult it was on the front end, I don't know if I would be doing it, you know, but I think every person in America should have their own business at some point or another so they can appreciate what goes into it and how difficult it is and how rewarding it is and what a big part of the economy it is. It's just huge.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Megan Jones. She is president and CEO of Lokian. I completely concur with your statement about everyone should own a business. It would make everyone more empathetic to and appreciative of not only the difficulties in starting and operating a business and operating in the environment which government creates, but also, as you say, the rewards, which are considerable, and that real link between effort and results or effort and outcome is nice. Let me ask you this. I find that for urban leaders, it's really hard for them when they develop economic development strategies. Very hard for them to get their arms around small business. And frequently, small business ends up as this attachment that is small business equals struggling, poor, minority, women, African Americans, Vietnam vets, you know, the whole disabled people, the whole minority category. And that's small business.
Right.
Instead of small business is a dynamic sector on its own that includes many minority CEOs and founders, which is great, but it's not considered to be a sector that really contributes. It contributes to diversity, not to economic dynamism. Do you sense that?
I completely concur. And I think one of my passions, particularly in the past year, is Lokian has gone from being a baby to a toddler. I don't think you can necessarily make an entrepreneur. I don't think you can make someone into an entrepreneur. I think you can encourage entrepreneurial thinking. And it's always a struggle with me. I'm on several task force within our Chamber of Commerce, and I was at a strategic planning session last week where they stated some sort of statistic like the majority of the members of the Chamber of Commerce are small business. Yet a lot of their efforts go to wooing, identifying and wooing other businesses to come locate here as opposed to growing the companies that are here. And I think it's because they don't really know how to address it. They don't know what the needs are. They think small business sometimes tends to be used a little bit pejoratively. And I tell people all the time, it's like, I don't have a small business. It's big business to me. You know, every time I look at it and I think about it, when I go to sleep, when I wake up in the morning, it's big. And I don't have a roadmap for city officials to be able to support the small business sector in a meaningful way. I don't have that in my mind. But what I do try to always encourage them and encourage other people is to not always think that people want a job. You know, how can we find trailing spouses who have, husbands or wives who move to the city? How can we help them find a job? How can we help people here find a job? It's not about finding a job sometimes. Sometimes it's about doing your own thing. And I think what bugs me recently in culture and the media is that I see people who would much rather be Donald Trump's apprentice than Donald Trump. And so I always try to tell people, you know, do you value your independence over your lifestyle? I do. You know, and I tell people that who come to, you know, interview at Lokian, I'm really hard on them. I was like, do you want a life or do you want a lifestyle? I mean, I think that we provide a different kind of life, a little bit more independent, a little less political, a little less, I don't know, not numbing. I don't want to go to the extreme and then be, you know, have condemnation for corporate life. But I do think that without the small businesses of the world, you know, you got to start somewhere. You don't immediately come out of the gate being Google.
Well, you said you don't have a roadmap, Megan, for city officials or Chamber of Commerce officials to support small business. But can you think of one or two things that they could do better? I mean, you've already named one, and that is simply recognize that small business and entrepreneurs are a dynamic sector of the economy. Beyond that, is there anything specific you can think of that they could do to encourage entrepreneurs like you?
Sometimes the goal of small business is not necessarily to get big. You know, for me, it is my goal is to have a great, healthy, successful business, whether that means big or not. And I think what sometimes we see, particularly with developers or people who are offering incentives for business to come and grow, is that they want the big. Who's coming in, who's big, or who is going to be big, or we're going to hold out and we're not going to rent this retail space for anything less than, you know, $11 million a square foot because we're holding out for the day that the Gap comes downtown or whatever it is. Sometimes I think that starting small or medium size should be okay, and that I wish that they were more the collective they being developers and Chamber of Commerce and city officials and people who give tax breaks and money and whatnot, were more willing to go for an efficiency or a sufficiency instead of a surplus, not the biggest buck and not the smallest. And I think that shows, and our culture is always, it, particularly now with like reality TV, you're going for the drama, you're going for, you know, the small business sob story where you max out your credit cards and generally life is not like that. And so to be satisfied with your place in the economy and, you know, what you're doing, I look around, those 20 people have husbands and wives and girlfriends and kids, and you know, we make jobs and we make solutions and we rent square footage, and those are a lot of things that come out of our company that are not huge but richly rewarding. They're contributions, they're meaningful contributions. So I think that would be one thing. Keep the eye on the prize, but also foster some middle ground.
Megan, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Megan Jones is founder and president of Lokian. CityView's commentator Walker Smith each week joins us to give us his very personal views of life in cities.
Baby boomers are in the headlines again. The leading edge is turning 60, so boomers have made the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the covers of Newsweek, Business Week, American Heritage, and Parade. NBC and ABC have aired features on their evening news shows. This happens every time boomers pass another age milestone. Any excuse to ponder yet again the pig and the python. But after a while, it's too much. One more boomer story after another can get tiresome, and in a metaphorical way, even mirror the caricature of interminable boomer self-fascination and self-congratulation. Pretty soon, it can seem like the whole idea of the baby boom is nothing but hype to sell newspapers, or at best, a dead horse beaten to a pulp. But there is a good reason why the demographic anomaly known as the baby boom deserves this attention. Fertility rates were in a long-term decline prior to World War II. In fact, they were headed towards a level that would be below replacement rates, and demographers were forecasting a shrinking population. The baby boom confounded these predictions. In 1946, for the first time ever, the number of births exceeded 3 million, a record topped the very next year. Births remained above 3 million, and a new record was set in 1951, then again in 1952, and then again in 1953. The next new record in 1954 surpassed 4 million births. Births stayed above 4 million each year through 1964. With new records in 1955, 1956, and 1957, which was the peak year, although it was nearly matched in 1961, the second highest year. Finally, after 1964, the number of births dropped below 4 million. The boom was over. At the end of the boom in 1964, baby boomers made up 40% of the population, which is to say that nearly half the nation's population had been born in the prior 18 years. By contrast, people under 18 today make up only 25% of the population. By the end of the baby boom, fertility rates had returned to a pattern of long-term decline that remains true today. Births did not exceed 4 million again until 1989, when the biggest part of the baby boom started having children en masse. Yet 4 million births in 1989 is not particularly impressive, considering that the total population that year was almost 30% larger than in 1964. What's impressive is the impact that baby boomers can have simply by virtue of their numbers. This is the root fascination with baby boomers: the impact of big numbers on business, politics, and popular culture. Baby boomers aren't special because they all went to Woodstock or dodged the draft or turned into yuppies and soccer moms or took up yoga and windsurfing, because they all didn't. But there is one thing that all baby boomers share. Each and every one is part of a supernova of numbers that has changed everything it has touched. Critics and naysayers notwithstanding, this is why baby boomers deserve the headlines, because their extraordinary numbers will continue to make them matter in unprecedented and remarkable ways. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.